Fairweel to all our Scottish fame. Fairweel, our ancient glory. Fairweel, even to the Scottish name, sae famed in martial story. Now's hark rins o'er the Solway sands, and Tweed rins to the ocean, to mark where England's province stands, such a pass of rogues in a nation. What force Sir Kyle could not subdue, through many warlike ages, is wrought now by a coward few, for hireling traitors' wages. The English teal we could disdain, secure in valor's station, but English gold has been our bane, such a path of rogues in a nation. Oh, would or I had seen the day that treason thus could sell us, my old grey head had lain in clay with Bruce and loyal Wallace. But pith and power, till my last hour, I'll make this declaration: we're bought and sold for English gold, such a pass of rogues in a nation.
That's Bill Drummond's recording of Parcel of Rogues, a poem by Robbie Burns that was written in 1791, almost a century after the events that prompted it took place. It's the lament of a small nation for the loss of its independence, for what the poet sees as its reduction to the status of a province, of a larger, richer neighbour. And it's more than a lament, it's an accusation, pointing the finger at a corrupt elite that, in the poet's eyes, literally sold their country out. What force or guile could not subdue through many warlike ages is wrought now by a coward few for hireling traitors' wages. I should point out here that not all scholars agree with either the sentiment or the analysis. Christopher Whatley, Emeritus Professor of Scottish History and a former Vice-Principal of the University of Dundee, as well as a prominent opponent of Scottish independence, points out that the song is actually a 17th century folk song. However, the argument that Scotland is somehow a separate nation with its own distinct history is not a particularly tough one to make. When 2 millennia ago, the southern parts of the island of Britain became part of the Roman Empire, the tribes inhabiting the northern part retained their freedom of action. That was even after what appears to be an attempted genocide by Gnaeus Julius Agricola, governor of the province of Britannia between 77 and 85 CE. The Romans had another go at Scottish genocide between 209 and 211 under Septimius Severus and his son Caracalla, but they gave up after Septimius died and Caracalla rushed back to Rome to claim the throne. A couple of walls and about 3 centuries after arriving, the Romans gave up trying to keep the Scots out of the northern parts of the province of Britannia. And 383, and in 410 CE, the legions finally left the British Isles entirely. But subsequently, the relationship between the two countries has never been entirely easy or peaceful, although conflict between the two sides probably hasn't been as brutal as it was in the 14th century, and the last formal battle between the Scots and English was in 1547. The rapport has typically been somewhat prickly. I mean, at certain junctures, the two have even shared monarchs. In fact, they do now. There's been complete freedom of movement between the two sides for hundreds of years. Scots fought in the British Army, manned the British Empire, banked it. Think HSBC and RBS, etc. HSBC, it was said to stand for Home for Scottish Bank Clerks. But the list goes on and on. The British Empire was, to a large extent, administered by Scots. But Burns still speaks for many Scots in the following lines of that poem. The English steel we could disdain, secure in valour's station, but English gold has been our bane, such a parcel of rogues in a nation. To quote Neil Davidson, the British Unionist and Scottish Nationalist positions can be summarised as follows. The former celebrates the Union as a gift, which Scottish leaders wisely accepted on behalf of a nation that has never subsequently wished to reject it. The latter denounces the Union as a trap into which an unrepresentative oligarchy led a Scottish people who have never subsequently found the will to escape. In a strange way, they're both right. That lost independence rankles in Scotland. In a way, it doesn't in Wales. Or it doesn't seem to an outsider. It's an itch that the Scots continually scratch at, a sore spot the English continually aggravate, a resentment that's continually present in Scots' view of the Union and is stoked each time the English ignorantly tread on Scots' sensibilities. The most recent example was the referendum on EU membership, in which 62% of Scots voted to remain, while the English decided to leave, 53% to 47%. Given that the EU is a sort of system whereby the smaller nations team up to limit the freedom of action of the bigger ones, that vote, and the bitterness it caused in Scotland, is a sign of the seriousness with which the Scots take their nationhood. So, what happened? How did this unhappy marriage come about? To find out, we need to take a look at an adventure that flopped three centuries ago, and which was the immediate cause, the proximate cause, behind two nations joining together in a not-so-sacred union. Hello and welcome to the Boom and Bust podcast. My name is John, and thank you for listening to the story. It's at this point that I should acknowledge that although the name of this show is the Boom and Bust podcast, in this particular story there really is no boom, just a bust. However, it was a bust that cost a nation its independence, so no small matter. An argument can perhaps be made that its independence would ultimately have been lost in any case, that two nations with such intertwined histories, sharing the same small island as do England and Scotland, well, that was not a durable arrangement in the long term, as modern nation-states took shape and the importance of scale increased. However, this was the event that triggered the process that led to the loss of sovereignty that many Scots still don't accept. In a 2013 lecture titled The Disunited Kingdom, England, Ireland and Scotland, Jonathan Sumption, a noted historian and former member of the Supreme Court, quoted Harvard political scientist Carl Deutsch as saying, quote, "A nation is a group of people united by a mistaken view of their past and a common hatred of their neighbours," end quote. According to Sumption, French historian Ernest Renan, speaking in 1888, quote, "thought that the major European nation-states of his own day would survive for centuries, yet by his test, even they were fragile constructs. Sentiments change. External threats recede to expose the fault lines within historic nations. The memory of joint triumphs fades away, to be replaced by the more durable recollection of real or imagined oppression and antagonism," end quote. In his lecture, Sumption went on to point out that because of its size, its population, and its central position geographically, The history of the United Kingdom is essentially the story of England's relations with the other nations of the British Isles. And in many ways, the story of Scotland's debacle in South America, for such it was, and its loss of independence, is also the story of England's efforts to ensure that the adventure went wrong and to turn the accident to its own advantage. Our story starts with pirates, the buccaneers that infested the Caribbean and the shores of Central America from about 1650 to 1730. One particular pirate, called Lionel Wafer. He was a Welsh surgeon, afflicted with an insatiable travel bug. So he headed off to Jamaica. After a few years there, he was persuaded to join a pirate ship as a colleague of William Dampier, another pirate, an unusual one, a pirate of exquisite mind, as one of his biographers calls him, who circumnavigated the globe three times, collected plants, and whose work helped Charles Darwin in forming his theory of evolution. An odd pirate, all in all. In 1680, Wafer found himself tramping across the Isthmus of Darien. That's sort of where the Panama Canal is these days, linking the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. On the trip, Wafer was injured when, during a break, a fellow traveller was messing with some gunpowder and, quote, not managing it as he should, end quote. The gunpowder exploded, ripping a hole in Wafer's leg, exposing the bone above his knee. The result was that he had to be left behind, cared for by the local indigenous tribe, the Kuna. This was important because Wafer survived the experience, and when he returned to Britain, he wrote a book about it. He chronicled both the advantages and the drawbacks of the isthmus, his descriptions of the lushness of the forests, the amount and variety of wildlife, and of the Kuna themselves, including their potential as allies. Against any possible Spanish interference, these were all used to sell Darien as a spot where a settlement could be placed. The drawbacks, he mentioned, were conveniently ignored. A settlement, I hear you ask. Yes, a settlement, a Scottish settlement, with a view to creating something rather larger. This was, after all, the age of European imperialism. The European powers were busy using the technologies they developed to kill each other to subdue people all around the globe. As we all now know, they were helped in this by their germs. The French, the British, the Spanish and Portuguese, not forgetting the Dutch, were all busy in the New World. The Caribbean islands were also popular because of sugar production. Those Brits with a robust constitution, a taste for adventure and a bit of slaving could make a fortune from the sugar trade. And if they survived, which shouldn't be taken for granted, they could retire to an estate in the English countryside. Or they could follow the example of Edward Colston and go in for a bit of philanthropy in, say, Bristol. Colston certainly was responsible for many of Bristol's civic amenities, but on the negative side of the ledger, apparently almost 20,000 slaves perished in his ships on their way to be worked to death in the Caribbean. Here I should reintroduce another of our protagonists. This was William Paterson, a friend of Robinson Crusoe author Daniel Defoe. Paterson was a Scottish-born merchant. Okay, to tell it like it is, like it was, he was basically a slave trader, and perhaps a bit of a pirate too. But he made his fortune in the Caribbean and then returned to live in London. He went via Holland, where he invested in the Dutch banks. Holland, of course, was at this point more developed financially than other countries. So it was probably in Holland that Paterson got the idea that the English government, under King William III of the Hanoverian dynasty, might find that owning a bank would come in handy when it came to paying for its pretty much forever war with France. The government eventually agreed, and the governor and company of the Bank of England was born in 1694, with Paterson as a director. Come 1695, Paterson, no longer a director of the BOA, there was a rabbit hole. I went down it, but I could see no light at the end. There was some sort of a scandal. Paterson was in Edinburgh, where he persuaded the Scottish government that it also needed a bank. That led to the founding of, what else? The Bank of Scotland in 1696. As a parenthesis, that institution became Halifax Bank of Scotland, or HBOS, in 2001, merging to take advantage of light-touch regulation and the real estate boom of those years. It overexpanded and got into trouble during the financial crisis in 2008. Then Prime Minister George Brown, another Scot, persuaded Lloyds Bank to buy it, a move that ended up pushing Lloyds itself into the arms of the government. Good times. The Company of Scotland, trading to Africa and the Indies, that was its name, was set up in 1695, seeking to muscle in on the activities of the Royal African Co. Basically, if a little reductively, the slave trading arm of the English elite. The Royal African Company and the East India Company. It wasn't originally intended to go off and try to settle Darien or anywhere else. The plan was to raise £600,000 as a starting capital, drawing on the resources of both London, home then as now to a large Scottish community, and Scotland. This took a mere 2 weeks in November 1695. The plan was supposed to be a secret, but of course things leaked. As Professor David Armitage notes in his book, The Scottish Vision of Empire, the idea, quote, of a free port channeling East India goods into Europe with Scottish plantations undercutting the English colonies' prices in the Americas, end quote. Well, that wasn't one that the East India Company or its investors found particularly attractive. Shares in the East India Company fell, and opponents got to work. Those opponents included much of mercantile London, who were concerned that the trade the Scots picked up would come at their expense. The House of Lords proposed banning English investment in the Scottish company, as well as preventing it from acquiring English ships or hiring English seamen. The King turned hostile, and the London part of the subscription was dumped. Interestingly, Paterson was slated to receive 4% of the money to be raised in the initial capital raising, something that was controversial at the time, just as it would be today. He eventually had to drop this. The failure of the English end of the operation was, of course, a provocation to the Scots, who instead, between individuals and institutions, coughed up £400,000, basically to stick it to the English. I should at this point say that some of these sums of money sound like not very much these days, the price of a small house in some part of London, or even a garage. But back in the day, these were enormous sums of money, although it's rather pointless to attempt conversion. At this point in time, Scotland wasn't an essentially happy place. Apart from the weather, this is never very good in Scotland, but at the end of the 17th century it was terrible. As I described in my episode on John Law's Mississippi scheme, the 1690s were the high point, that's the worst part, of the so-called Little Ice Age, a period of cold and damp that hammered crop yields across Europe. The Great Famine of 1695 to 1697 may have killed anything up to 25% of the population across a swathe of northern European countries, including Scotland. As usual, food shortages led to unstable politics, meaning wars and rebellions were very much part of the landscape at this time. Even as the region recovered from the 30 Years' War, a meat grinder of a conflict, unequalled in its lethality until the 1914 war. And of course, the events that would lead to the War of the Spanish Succession, 1701 to 1713, were swirling through the European politics of the time. Add into that unhappy mixture rising protectionism around Europe and in its colonies, probably inspired by the example of Jean-Baptiste Colbert in France, as well as the depredations of French pirates. And Scotland, as a trading nation, wasn't in a great place. It was a somewhat inhospitable place under what arguably amounted to economic sanctions. The English Navigation Acts, which were part of the protectionist mosaic that was strangling trade in the second half of the 17th century, also hindered Scotland's maritime development. The result was that Scotland didn't have free trade with England or with its colonies and wasn't properly independent at sea. So, yay, it was time for Scotland to get on the bandwagon and create its own colonies, its own sphere of influence, its own sunlit highlands, see what I did there, where it could bask in the bright light of imperial success and once more stick it to the goddamn English. After all, Scotland did have some experience at attempting empire. There was Nova Scotia, the clue is in the name, 1620s, perhaps an attempt on the Caribbean island of Dominica in 1671 that I can't find out much about, as well as some short-lived efforts at setting up colonies in North America. A burgeoning imperial power, essentially, it wasn't. As we've seen, the original aim for the Company of Scotland wasn't to settle the Darien Isthmus. Rather, it was to get in on the spice trade dominated by the East India Company and perhaps take on the Royal African Company in the slave trade. Unfortunately for the Scots, the English weren't about to sit back and let that happen, so an alternative had to be found, and reorientating efforts toward the paradise our pirate Wafer had described in Darien looked more and more attractive. These days, the temptation is to dismiss the Darien scheme as a harebrained, madcap adventure. That would never work. After all, this was part of Spain's territorial monopoly, one that it jealously enforced. At this point, Spain regarded interlopers into its provinces as straightforward pirates, especially if those interlopers were Protestants and spoke English. Add to that the nature of the terrain in Darien, mangroves, swamps, mosquitoes and so on. That was no help at all. However, it's worth pointing out that the Spanish hold on its New World possessions was often tenuous at best, with its soldiers confined to their various outposts and forts, which were often racked by epidemics. The people who were in charge in Darien were the local tribes, that is, the Cuna, who were hostile to the Spanish and probably willing to aid Scottish efforts in their outpost. That said, the Darien Isthmus in particular did have a very important role to play in Imperial Spain's plundering of the New World. This is from the book The Price of Scotland, Darien, Union and the Wealth of Nations by Douglas Watt. Quote, by the middle of the 16th century, the isthmus was the fulcrum of the Spanish imperial economy. Each year, convoys of merchantmen, protected by armed ships, sailed up the Pacific coast of South America, loaded with silver from the vast mines such as Potosi in modern-day Bolivia, and at Panama City on the south side of the isthmus. The treasure was packed on mules across to Portobello on the north, and then transported by the Spanish Galeones fleet to Seville or Cadiz, end quote. What this meant was that the Scots were planning to set up a settlement that aimed to function as a sort of trading post, an Amsterdam-style entrepot, or as cynics might call it, a potentially hostile settlement right in the middle of an area of strategic importance to the imperial power of the era. This was not a guarantee of success, even with the support of the locals. On top of that, William III's geopolitical strategy at this point called for keeping the Spanish sweet, and a bunch of his subjects, don't forget, William was king of both England and Scotland, a bunch of his subjects setting up on the doorstep of the Spanish Empire wasn't going to make him popular in Madrid. The corollary of all this was that Spain's rival powers, in this case the English, but not only the English, were watching what was going on very carefully indeed. As it turned out, those rival powers probably had a better idea of what was afoot long before some of the would-be settlers did. After all, the final destination wasn't revealed to those aboard until they were at sea, to prevent the English finding out and potentially claiming right of settlement by getting there first. However, it does seem to have been something of an open secret in the elite circles in London and Edinburgh, and probably in other European capitals too. So, the Scots took the £400,000 they'd raised and bought ships in Amsterdam or Hamburg. 5 vessels, carrying 1,200 people, set sail from Leith in July 1698 and arrived in South America very late the following October or in early November. I've seen both mentioned. It was an odd choice of departure point. Leith is the port of Edinburgh on the eastern coast of Scotland, near where the royal yacht Britannia is currently moored as a tourist attraction. Therefore, to even get started, the settlers would have had to round the northern tip of Scotland, adding distance and stormy waters to their journey. But off they went, heading first for Madeira to buy wine and other supplies, and to open their orders, setting out the final destination, and from there across the Atlantic. Preparation for the expedition does seem to have been lacking. The settlers were short of basic provisions, although it seems they had plenty of Bibles. They also had weapons and ammunition, and once they'd found a harbour in Darien, they managed to set up a colony they dubbed New Caledonia, and they were the Caledonians, they decided. The area wasn't particularly hospitable, as we've seen, consisting of mangroves and swamps, with the variety of insect life, especially mosquitoes, that goes with wetlands. And it rained a lot. About 70 people of the 1,200 who'd set out had died, though, as Helen J. Paul, lecturer in economics and economic history at the University of Southampton, points out, this actually wasn't a bad casualty figure for an ocean crossing of this nature at the time. Shortly after the settlers' arrival, an unwelcome visitor showed up. This was one Captain Rodney Long, who supposedly was in the Caribbean to look for wrecked treasure ships. He wasn't. He was a spy for the English, hired by William III to find out exactly what the Scots were up to and where. Having found out, he hightailed it back to England. The New Caledonians, meanwhile, were in a pickle. The trade goods they had brought with them were of no interest either to the locals nor to the few merchants who happened to pass by. They wanted money, and the settlers had none. Their own supplies were insufficient, and their efforts to ensure they would be able to ward off an expected Spanish attack by building Fort St. Andrew, as well as the quality of the soil, meant they hadn't been able to grow their own food. Add in disease, including dysentery and malaria, which was carried by the mosquitoes in the area, and about 200 members of the population fell victim. By early 1699, the settlers were dying at the rate of 10 a day. And then there was the rain, which fell for weeks without pause, weeks on end. This was not a happy time. According to Michael Novak of Seton Hall University in New Jersey, the Spanish attacked New Caledonia several times, but weren't actually very good at it. Their first effort, launched in 1698, didn't even reach the settlement due to disorganisation, shortage of supplies, and the rain. The Spanish did eventually capture one of the settlement's ships. Other attempts were beaten back. Now, according to Novak and to many, many Scots, the real reason for the debacle, the real enemy of the New Caledonians, was the English. They are, of course, forgetting another enemy, just as important as the English, and that was the divided leadership of the colony. Here's Roger Oswald, one of the survivors, describing life in New Caledonia and the food available. It's quoted by Daniel Stirat of the University of Vienna in a 2010 paper. Quote, Roger Oswald, one of the surviving settlers, wrote about life on Darien that spring and spoke of the utter hardship that had befallen himself and his fellow settlers. When boiled with a little water, without anything else, big maggots and worms must be skimmed off the top. In short, a man might easily have destroyed his whole week's rationing in one day, and have but one ordinary stomach neither. Yet for all this short allowance, every man, let him be never so weak, daily turned out to work by daylight, whether with the hatchet, or wheelbarrow, pickaxe, shovel, forehammer, or any other instrument the case required, and so continued until 12 o'clock, and at 2 again, and stayed till night, sometimes working all day up to the headbands of the breaches in water at the trenches. My shoulders have been so wore with carrying burdens that the skin has come off them and grew full of boils. If a man were sick and obliged to stay within, no victuals for him that day. Our councillors all the while lying at their ease, sometimes divided into factions, and being swayed by particular interest, ruined the public. Our bodies pined away and grew so macerated with such allowance that we were like so many skeletons. Meanwhile, news of the difficulties the settlers were experiencing hadn't reached the homeland. There was talk instead of gold being there for the taking. Indeed, there were actually bits of Darien gold circulating, and a second expedition was agreed in March 1699. Three ships were kitted out to carry 500 colonists and 200 seamen off to the promised land, and they set off in May that year. This time, the ships left from the mouth of the River Clyde, which is on Scotland's west coast, thus sparing everyone the trip around the top of the country. Unfortunately, King William had but basically cut the ground from beneath the colony with an edict issued in April of that year, forbidding English subjects to trade or even correspond with the Scottish colonists. Any merchants from Jamaica and North America who were inclined to trade with the New Caledonians were forbidden from doing so. The result was to cut the starving Scots off from one of their last sources of food. In May that year, as the second expedition was leaving Scotland, the remaining settlers threw in the towel and left, heading for Jamaica and New York. The second expedition was as dysfunctional as the first, with disagreements among the leaders magnified by clashes among the led. This was because many on the second voyage were Highlanders who were illiterate and were Gaelic speakers who despised and were despised by the anglicised lowlanders. Here's a chap called Alexander Shields, a Presbyterian minister, commenting on the behaviour of his fellows, as cited by Novak of Seton Hall. Quote, our company, very uncomfortable, consisting for the generality, especially the officers and volunteers, of the worst of mankind. If you had scummed the land and raked to the borders of hell for them, men of lewd practices, and venting their wickedness of principles. End quote. And some doubts as to the wisdom of the whole thing were being sown at home. Also in 1699, Walter Herries, a surgeon on the first expedition, popped up in Bristol, furious at the mishandling of the affair by the directors of the company. He published a pamphlet entitled A defence of the Scots abdicating Darien, a partisan and vicious attack on the company. But Herries was a deserter from the first expedition and had good reason to be critical to justify his own actions. Shields' invective above gives an idea about how much everybody involved liked everyone else. Not much at all. Add in the weather, disease, hunger, incompetence, lack of preparation, and the hostility of the Spanish, and it's easy to see how unlikely it was that the Darien scheme would succeed. Even so, although the second expedition found the settlement abandoned, they had a shot at making a go of it. It was the Spanish that finished matters off, mounting a siege of Fort Arthur and forcing it to surrender in March 1700. The attackers allowed the survivors to leave the fort, but only a few ever saw Scotland again. The affair was a disaster for Scotland, an unmitigated disaster. The Darien scheme had sucked in the nation, swallowed its capital, killed more than 1,000 of its citizens, and there was nothing, nothing at all to show for it. Scotland had started out a poor country, with restricted trade in a mercantilist world, and now it was a much poorer country in that selfsame world. Darien had cost it about 25% of its liquid capital, scholars estimate. In a world of specie-based money, that was catastrophic. Something had to be done, and union with wealthier England, the England that many Scots held responsible for the Darien disaster, looked like a necessity. This isn't the place to go into the many and varied manoeuvrings that eventually led to the creation of the United Kingdom on May 1st, 1707. The Darien disaster wasn't the only issue that was pointing to union with England as the way out of the hole that Scotland was in. While the Scots elite was largely in favour of the union, the ordinary people were vehemently opposed to it. The problem was twofold. Its opponents were against it for a variety of conflicting reasons, and then there was the lack of alternatives. From the English point of view, the issue was the price that would have to be paid to keep Scotland away from an alliance with the French. This wasn't clear-cut. At the time, Scotland was bitterly divided along religious lines between the Highlanders, who were Catholic and supported the claims of the deposed Stuart dynasty, and the rest, who went in for a flinty Protestantism and supported anyone who wasn't Catholic. That's not to play down concern among Scottish Protestants that their church, known as the Kirk, would be suppressed in favour of the High Church Anglicanism of much of the English ruling class, which was one of the issues that fired up some opponents of union. Then there was the issue of what kind of union should be sought. Should it be a federal one? Or should it be incorporation, as had briefly happened under Oliver Cromwell in the mid-1600s? In the event incorporation was chosen, the Scottish Parliament voted itself out of existence, and the Scottish economy eventually benefited from the spoils of the British Empire. By the middle of the 18th century, Scots made up half the personnel of the East India Company, for example. The Scots were also enthusiastic colonists, settling in North America as well as Australia and New Zealand. In short, it's hard to argue that Scotland would have done better by remaining independent at the time. From Scotland's point of view, at the beginning of the 18th century, as a small nation, it would almost certainly have had to ally itself with a larger one. The choice really came down to either England or France. An alliance with France would certainly lead to war with England, given that the two were already fighting. An English victory in that conflict would mean union anyway, on terms dictated by the English. A French victory would mean an absentee king, which was one of the things that had caused many of Scotland's problems in the first place, or, alternatively, the return of the Stuart dynasty as a subaltern to the French and Catholicism. One of England's priorities was to ensure that the Hanoverian succession to the throne was respected, and one of the ways of guaranteeing that was to ensure control of Scottish politics. The Scottish Parliament at the time was a much less than democratic body, even by comparison with England's none too representative legislature. Far from being a representative body, fewer than one in 1,000 of the population elected the Scottish members, making it, in fact, a feudal holdover. Opponents of incorporation didn't have a lot of mileage in insisting that the Parliament remain as it was then constituted. Adding to the pressure, England was threatening tougher economic sanctions against Scotland if it refused to negotiate a union. In the end, union by incorporation was forced through, and with it, the Scottish gained free trade with England and its colonies, and eventually, there was actually nothing immediate about it, a way out of their perpetual economic slump. In spite of the economic logic, passage through the Scottish Parliament wasn't a done deal, and the English had to agree to a number of tax exemptions to ensure it passed. A fair bit of bribery also took place. On top of that, in exchange for Scotland agreeing to share in England's national debt, adopting English coinage, and to repay the losses incurred in the Darien scheme, the English handed over almost £400,000, a sum known as the equivalent. Of this, about £233,000 was for the Darien losses. With all that agreed and ratified by the two parliaments, the United Kingdom of Great Britain was born. Even so, the UK remains an invented country, valid only as long as external forces conspire to hold it together. In the beginning, these forces were strong. The need to keep Scotland on side in England's incessant wars with France, a shared Protestantism, or at least anti-Catholicism, among the elites, and of course the growing empire. With the passage of time, the forces of cohesion have weakened. No one except the most paranoid Brexiteer thinks the EU is massing an army to invade the British Isles. It's a voluntary union, and Scotland was a willing volunteer, as were a bit less than half of English voters. To Scotland's chagrin, the greater number of English voters gave them the final word, as ever. The empire has gone, dead for almost a century, and the churches are mostly empty. The justification for the UK in an age when nationalism is devolving to the local level, at the expense of the centralised state, seems thin. It's true that the UK has taken some steps in the direction of a more federal union, with the establishment of the devolved Scottish Parliament. That might have supplied cover for a gradually increased repatriation of powers from London to Edinburgh, in the context of shared membership of the EU. However, that cover has now gone, and it's looking more like London is running the show to the detriment of Scotland. Instead, Scotland, as a group of people united by a mistaken view of their past and a common hatred of their neighbours, is coming to the fore. It remains to be seen whether the economic benefits of union with an England and Wales outside of the European mainstream will be enough to persuade Scots to remain in their unhappy and one-sided marriage. Okay, we'll end it there. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to subscribe on all the main podcatching services, which also have the previous episodes of the show. Rate and review the show, particularly on Apple Podcasts. Tweet about it. Put it on LinkedIn. Wear a sandwich board. All of which will help convince me I'm not just talking to myself. And please accept my apologies for the late arrival of this episode. That has to do with a little extra work, a fairly minor change in family circumstances, and my general disorganisation. As ever, the guitar music used is by Clive Carroll. It's a piece called All This Time from his album Life in Colour. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next time.